Good afternoon. I guess we'll get started. My name is Jenny Bouvier, and I'm Senior Program Officer here at the Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program at the Institute. On behalf of USIP, I'd like to welcome you here as we near the end of this year's series of Senior Fellow Project Reports. These events have been providing the public with opportunities to hear about the fellows' works in progress, U.S. tax dollars at work, and for the fellows as well to get feedback on their projects from USIP staff and from the broader Washington policy community. Today, Senior Fellow Ratini Suberu will speak about managing federal-state conflicts, the role of Nigeria's Supreme Court, part of a book manuscript he's been working on about federalism in Nigeria. His paper, which has been distributed on the tables in front of you, and today's talk will address the challenges and limits of judicial federalism in managing violent conflict. Ratini Suberu was a senior fellow at USIP in 1993 to 1994, which resulted in the publication of Federalism and Ethnic Conflict in Nigeria in 2001. Suberu's current work analyzes the record of Nigerian federalism since the end of military rule in 1999, where his earlier work left off. Federalism is increasingly employed as a governance mechanism in post-conflict societies to manage ethnic tensions. During the two constitutional terms of President Obasanjo, Dr. Suberu's work shows how Nigeria's Supreme Court has evolved into a prominent and independent referee of intergovernmental disputes and has become a key site for mediation of debates over oil resource management, revenue allocations, implementation of Sharia law, control of the police, and the status of local governments. What do the rulings of the court tell us about the role the judiciary might play in managing ethno-political tensions, communal violence, and conflicting regional interests? What are the implications of this model for other ethnically divided societies? Dr. Suberu is well placed to consider such questions. He's been a professor of political science at Nigeria's University of Ibadan since 1986, and is one of Nigeria's leading experts on federalism. In addition to his aforementioned book, he is also the author of a book called Ethnic Minority Conflicts and Governance in Nigeria. Dr. Suberu traveled to Nigeria for 3 weeks this past April to observe the country's general elections for the Transition Monitoring Group, the largest domestic election observation team. Dr. Suberu has served as a consultant to the Nigerian government, the EU delegation to Abuja, the National Democratic Institute, the National Endowment for Democracy, and the Council on Foreign Relations Center for Preventive Action. He recently coordinated a research program on ethnic and federal studies funded by the Ford Foundation. During this fellowship, Dr. Suberu authored an article on Nigerian federalism, which has been accepted for publication in the October edition of Journal of Democracy. He's given presentations at American University, CICE, the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and the University of California at Santa Cruz. Dr. Suberu also presented a paper on Sharia and democratic federalism at the University of California at Los Angeles. His work complements other current initiatives at the Institute, engaging in mediation work between Christians and Muslims in Plateau State, supporting Track 2 reconciliation efforts in the Niger Delta, and supporting research and training and grants to address the various kinds of political, ethnic, religious, structural, and regional violence that plague Nigeria today. In his months as a fellow, Ratini has been an active participant in the Institute's Nigeria Working Group, has closely worked with David Smock and the Center for Mediation and Conflict Resolution, and has provided ongoing guidance to staff on developments in Nigeria. Before we hear from Dr. Suberu, I do have just a few housekeeping items. First, I'd like to say a word of thanks to those who helped with the organization of this event, and I'd like to recognize in particular Allison Witkoff in the corner, who's a research assistant with Ratini and has just completed her MA program in International Studies at the Elliott School of George Washington. She's been a delight to work with and is now entering the job market. I'm sure she'd welcome any input from any of you around the table on job prospects in this field. Secondly, I would ask that you please turn off your cell phones and any other electronic devices that you have, as they will interfere with the sound system for the event. Also, if you need to duck out to make a cell phone call, please go all the way into the lobby, because these offices are used by other people right outside this room. A summary of this event will be available later from the USIP website. Finally, I would add our usual disclaimer that Ratini Suberu's remarks do not necessarily reflect the position of the Institute, which does not take policy positions. and now I'll turn it over to the team.
Thank you very much, Jimmy. Since this will be the last public opportunity I'll have to make some acknowledgements, I want to start by just acknowledging the support of the Institute. I think it's a privilege to be a fellow here. And I want to thank those who have contributed to making my stay here quite productive, beginning with my program officer, Jimmy, who has just introduced me, Alison Witkoff, my research assistant for very invaluable research assistance. The Nigerian team led by David Smock for the kind of stimulation they provided. And then the Jenny's Randolph program team headed by John Christ, and including Shira and Erin for their support. And for all of you who have come to attend this event, including my good friends Carl, Levan, Patrick Ukasa, Peter Lewis. Now this project, this report is part of the project I'm going on managing Nigeria's federal democracy. The project seeks to examine and explain the record of federal democracy in Nigeria since 1999, and that record has been deeply ambivalent. In the sense that, you know, for those who follow Nigerian events, you've had, you know, a lot of violence, communal violence. You've had a lot of corruption of the democratic process, as we've seen with the recent Nigerian elections. At the same time, the system seems to be resilient, and there seems to be some positive futures to the whole unfolding process, including the role of the judiciary, which I'll be discussing today. The current project builds on my earlier work, which resulted in the book Federalism and Ethnic Conflict in Nigeria. That book focused largely on the evolution and operation of Nigerian federalism under military rule. And, you know, federalism as it operates under the military is significantly different from the way it operates in a democratic system. And one of the major differences is what I'll be discussing today, you know, the role of the judiciary. Under the military, the judiciary was subordinated and repressed. And a lot of the what I'll be discussing today relates to conflicts between the federal government and the states over key constitutional issues. Now, it's unthinkable for a military governor of a state in Nigeria to take the federal military government to court. So, you know, issues of judicial federalism are simply non-existent under the military. The basic argument that I'm trying to develop in my evolving book project focuses on what I call the distinction between Nigeria's comparatively remarkable federal structures, including the constitution and the territorial configuration of the federation on the one hand, and the relatively weak and incomplete federal processes, especially the party system, on the other hand. And my argument is that Nigeria's current federalism exhibits many structural and constitutional features that several analysts will consider to be actually judicious, although there is no widespread scholarly consensus on what an optimal federal design is. And some of these structural and constitutional features that I think are comparatively remarkable include the fragmentation of core ethnic regions into two or more constituent federal units. The fact that, you know, the Yorubas, the Hausa Fulanis, and the Igbos are, you know, fragmented into different states rather than consolidated into a single unit from which they can become a threat to the integrity and viability of the federal system. Also, the demarcation of the federation into relatively small, plentiful, and symmetrically sized jurisdiction is one of the positive features of the federal design in Nigeria. There are also electoral incentives to encourage the formation of polity-wide parties. In other words, you don't have officially ethnic parties in Nigeria. Rather, both by constitutional design and by the kind of incentives built into the system, parties are interreligious in character, cross-regional, and multi-ethnic. So these are some of the, you know, remarkable features of the Nigerian federal system, which help to explain some of the resilience and some of the promise we see in Nigerian federalism in spite of the violence and the turbulence. And then I focus on, you know, the process aspect, which I see as more problematic. While the federal structures and functions seem to be relatively well designed, the federal processes to me seem to be incomplete. And by federal processes, I mean the more dynamic and operational aspects of the federal system, including the party system, the process of electoral politics, and the judiciary. And, you know, in talking about the process, I recognize that while the judiciary has played a relatively remarkable role, the other aspects of the processes in terms of the party system and electoral politics have been deeply flawed and explain some of the turbulence that we have seen in Nigeria. So hopefully this project will culminate in a 7-chapter book project, including chapters on the comparative aspects of federalism, the Nigerian Federation in comparative perspective, a chapter on Sharia law, and the travails of democratic federalism in Nigeria. Part of that is discussed in this current presentation, although as you will see if you read the paper, the Supreme Court, in a way, expediently avoided dealing with the issue of Sharia, of the constitutionality of Sharia, by arguing that the action of the Kano state government challenging the federal government's ban on the Sharia police, the ISBA, should be, you know, taken to a lower court. My book also discusses ethnic indigenous settler conflicts, the politics of oil revenue allocation, which is also partly highlighted in the current presentation. Then the chapter on judicial federalism, which is the most completed part of the project and which I'll be presenting today. A chapter on electoral politics, and a final chapter on the politics and prospects of constitutional reform. So I go on to discuss the current presentation, which is the chapter on judicial federalism, the role of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, as many of us who live in, for example, in this country, will know, plays a very critical role in interpreting and upholding the federal constitution, in adapting this basic law to changing circumstances, and in arbitrating intergovernmental disputes. I argue that this role of the Supreme Court can be paradoxically critical and problematic in federations like Nigeria with volatile internal divisions and weak public institutions. Basically, I identify some challenges to the role of the Supreme Court in a setting like Nigeria. The first challenge is the challenge of ethnic, regional, and religious diversity. The Supreme Court has as one of its major roles arbitrating conflicts between the federal government and the state governments. In ethnically divided countries like Nigeria, these federal-state conflicts tend to also reflect ethnic, regional, and linguistic divisions. And as Horowitz has argued in an article, in a recent article in the Journal of Democracy, arbitrating ethnic conflicts, arbitrating ethnic, regional, and religious conflicts is a kind of non-judicial function that risk undermining the acceptance of functional adjudication. And, you know, we've seen this partially in the attempts by the Supreme Court to intervene or arbitrate the issue of oil revenue allocation, which is basically a regional conflict between the Niger Delta states and the rest of the federation. Also, another apart from the challenge of ethnic, regional, and religious diversity, another challenge to judicial federalism in a country like Nigeria is the long period of military rule, during which the autonomy of the judiciary was undermined, and also the fact that the country for a long time was, at least at the moment of independence, started as a parliamentary, a British-style parliamentary political system reflecting its colonial legacy. And one of the major distinctions between a parliamentary system and a presidential system, an American-style presidential system, is that the autonomy of the judiciary is more institutionally entrenched under a federal presidential system than under a parliamentary system, where the notion of parliamentary sovereignty tends to be privileged over the notion of judicial autonomy. Another challenge for judicial federalism in a country like Nigeria is the contentious constitutional framework that we currently have in the country. I would argue that the 1999 constitution is contentious more in procedural terms than in substantive terms. In other words, to buttress the argument I've made, I think the constitution itself is a relatively solid document in terms of the kind of provisions that it has put in place for the formation of polity-wide parties, for a relatively center-dominated federalism and other futures. But the procedure by which the constitution was ratified is contentious, and many in Nigeria argue that the constitution is basically illegitimate, and there are several recommendations for amending the constitution. So if the constitutional framework is contentious, and if the Supreme Court is supposed to in a way apply the constitution, it becomes a challenge. It becomes a challenge for the courts, that the kind of constitution they are trying to interpret and uphold is basically contentious, and in some of its provisions ambiguous. Finally, a final challenge is that there is in fact a general weakness of institutions in countries like Nigeria, reflecting the fact that these are relatively recent states. Nigeria is less than 50 years old as an independent nation state. And also reflecting the fact that there is so much premium on the control of political power, which makes any notion of the rule of law very vulnerable. And as I discuss in my paper, in fact, there is a old tradition of analysis in Nigerian politics that argues that what reigns in the continent is what is called patrimonialism, new patrimonialism, personal rule, violence, a culture of impunity, rather than the rule of law. As I argue in my paper, I think this whole new patrimonial paradigm tends to trivialize the kind of progress towards institutionalization in countries like Nigeria. It is simplistic to dismiss Nigeria as a case of pure patrimonial rule when we are confronted with the evidence of the role of institutions like the Supreme Court and the way the Supreme Court is trying to arbitrate and respond to conflicts in the federal system. So basically, the centerpiece of my project report deals with 14 different decisions that the Supreme Court has made relating to conflicts between the federal government and the states. And these 14 different decisions can be summarized under four broad headings, namely the conflict over natural resources and what is called the derivation principle, the conflict over revenue allocation, the conflict over the control of local governments, and the conflicts over policing and public security. And I've presented a table in the presentation, I think on pages 11 to 12, which summarize the main decision of the Supreme Court in respect of these 14 different conflicts, and also tries to determine whether those decisions promoted federal government supremacy and of consequent state autonomy. To quickly go over some of these cases. The conflict of natural resources and the derivation principle involved a conflict between the oil producing states and the federal government over a constitutional provision that, you know, says the federal government should allocate 13% of oil mineral resources on a derivation basis. The derivation principle simply prescribes that, simply states that, simply recommends the exclusive allocation of centrally collected revenues to their units of origin. And according to the Nigerian Constitution, 13% of natural resource revenue should be returned exclusively to the areas where these resources are derived. Now, the problem that posed for oil resources in Nigeria was whether this derivation principle should apply only to onshore oil resources or to offshore, or should include offshore oil resources. And in the case of Nigeria, the problem is compounded by the fact that the Constitution actually vets all natural resources in the federal government. So you had a kind of tension or ambiguity between a constitutional provision that says that revenues from natural resources should be allocated partly on a derivation basis, and another provision that says that all natural oil resources are actually vested in the federal government. And you know, when this case was taken to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court initially decided that offshore oil resources belong to the Federation as a whole, and that they are not subject to the derivation principle. And it cited a number of reasons why this should be so. One of which is the fact that the continental shelf of the country actually is really not a part of the country, but is ascribed to the country as a result of international conventions, which are only given effect domestically by federal legislative competence, you know, rather than by states' authority. And of course, the decision of the Supreme Court in this instance generated a lot of controversy and bitterness in the Niger Delta. And the Supreme, you know, the federal government, in response to that bitterness in the Niger Delta, made a new law, which is called the abolition law in Nigeria, that it abolished the distinction between offshore and onshore oil revenues. And what then happened was that some of the non-oil producing states took the federal government to court for making a law that allowed some part of the offshore oil resources to be assigned to the Niger Delta states. And in a decision that seemed to reverse itself, the Supreme Court decided that that law was actually valid. Then I discussed revenue allocation disputes. The Supreme Court decisions in the area of revenue allocation basically was to ensure that the federal government conformed to the constitutional provisions on revenue allocation, which stipulates that virtually all centrally collected revenues, with very few exceptions, should be paid into a distributable pool and then shared among the three tiers of government according to a formula of the National Assembly. What was happening in Nigeria, both before the advent of the democratic government and even under the Obasanjo government, was that this basic constitutional provision that all federally collected revenues should be paid into a distributable account called the Federation account, and then distributed between the three levels of government in Nigeria, namely the federal government, the state government, and local government. This basic law was not being implemented in practice. For example, not all revenues that were collected by the federal government were paid into the Federation account or the distributable pool. In fact, according to one economist, as much as 50% of centrally collected revenues were being preempted, that is, were being diverted away from the Federation account. In addition, the federal government, instead of sharing those revenues strictly between the three levels of government, that is the federal government, the state government, and local governments, created other entities, like the so-called special funds, to which these revenues were also being paid. In other words, the states and the local governments were being shortchanged. And the Supreme Court tried with some success to stop these abuses, while generally upholding the federal government's broad mandate to design and administer Nigeria's public finance. For example, the Supreme Court decided that the federal government actually had the powers to formulate and to design the revenue allocation law, and that the federal president can modify the revenue allocation law to conform to constitutional provisions. The Supreme Court also decided that the federal government can set up an anti-corruption commission that can actually ensure some transparency in the utilization of these revenues. And we have, you know, we've seen from the recent developments in Nigeria that a lot of the state governors are now being challenged, are now being tried in federal courts because the federal government is given this power to ensure that there's some level of transparency in the utilization of public revenues. At the same time, the Supreme Court decided that all revenues transferred, all revenues meant for the local governments in Nigeria must be transferred, must be channeled through the state governments. This is supposed to protect the autonomy of the states and ensure that they are able to control the local government, that they have control over local government authorities in the states. And so another section of my report deals with the status of local governments in Nigeria. And here we find that the Constitution is ambiguous on the status of local governments. And this ambiguity derives basically from the attempt in Nigeria to make the local governments the third level of the federal system. In other words, unlike the classic American federal design, where the federal bargain is basically between the federal government and the states, in Nigeria, we've had an attempt to introduce the local governments as the third constitutionally entrenched level of the federal system. And this has created a lot of conflict between the federal government and the states over who should actually control the local governments. And one of the major decisions taken by the Supreme Court was to nullify a legislation of the National Assembly that extended the tenure of local councils. In other words, the Supreme Court argued that the tenure of local councils should be determined by the states and not by the federal government. Another decision taken by the Supreme Court, which I've already indicated, affirmed that federal revenues meant for the localities should be transferred through the states rather than given directly to the local governments. The Supreme Court also decided in another major suit that the federal government cannot monitor or regulate the utilization of federal revenues already transferred to the states for the benefit of their localities. Finally, and this is a reflection of the contradiction in the Supreme in the constitutional construction of the status of local governments, the Supreme Court argued that new local governments created by the states in Nigeria, although they may be valid, they remain inchoate, they remain incomplete until they are ratified by the National Assembly. And this dispute over local governments, you know, led to a major conflict, involved a major conflict between the Lagos state government and the federal government over the transfer of public revenues to local governments and over the creation of new local governments in Lagos state, as I've discussed in the paper. The final area of federal state conflict that I discussed in the paper relates to police and public security. Again, quite controversially, the Nigerian Constitution creates a single police force for the Federation. So Nigeria doesn't, you know, Nigeria basically has one single national police force. And the Constitution explicitly prohibits the formation of alternative police agencies. Now, this police is under the operational control of the Inspector General of Police, who is appointed by the president, and there are also state commissioners of police which regulate or which control the contingents of the police force in the states. And these are also basically appointed by the Police Service Commission, which is appointed by the president. In other words, both the head, the national head of the police force, and the heads of the state police institutions are either directly or indirectly appointed by the president. Under the Obasanjo, during the Obasanjo years, this highly centralized constitutional provisions of policing led to a lot of partisan and factional manipulation of the police by the presidency and by those in the presidency. And I discussed in the paper the example of Anambra State, where the police was used to abduct a governor, where the police security was withdrawn on the basis of a dubious court order from a neighboring state, and where the police stood idly by while arsonists destroyed the governor's office, apparently in an attempt to kind of provide a justification or a pretext for the declaration of a state of emergency by the president. And when this case came, you know, the Anambra case came before the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court, in a manner that underscores again the limits of judicial federalism, adopted a legalistic approach to the issue. It affirmed the authority of state governors to give operational, to give directions to the police forces in their states. At the same time, it refused to take a decision on some of the issues that the Anambra state government brought before the Supreme Court, especially regarding the role of the presidency in, and that those close to the president in trying to use the police to cause chaos and disorder in the states. Another case that I discussed in the paper relates to the issue of the establishment of the ISBA, which is a kind of state vigilante police by Sharia implementing states in Nigeria. Basically, the Kano state government had this Sharia police called the ISBA, which tried to enforce some aspects of Sharia law, including the ban on alcohol and the provision for gender segregated transportation. But the federal government announced a ban on the ISBA because it argued that the ISBA was getting some funding from foreign Islamist governments, and this provided a basis for the Kano state government to take the federal government to court in order to affirm its authority to establish law enforcement agencies. And many people thought this would provide an opportunity for the Supreme Court to take a decision on whether Sharia law was actually legitimate or not. But the position of the Supreme Court was that this was an issue that should be delegated to lower courts. Basically, the Supreme Court argued that the conflict between the Kano state government and the federal government was not a conflict on the relative powers of the federation and the states, but a conflict between a federal agency and a state agency, which should be resolved by the lower courts. In other words, the Supreme Court was ready to could decide on this on appeal, but not in the first instance. So this, you know, this was a lost opportunity or a missed opportunity for the Supreme Court to, you know, to pronounce on the legality or otherwise of Sharia courts. In, you know, in summary, looking at the various decisions taken by the Supreme Court in Nigeria, I argue that the Supreme Court has arbitrated these conflicts in an impressive, in a bold, and in a balanced manner. The Nigerian Supreme Court, in arbitrating federal-state conflicts, has not been a cannot be described as a promoter of federal hegemony. In other words, it has not been a centrist institution, because looking at the debates in, at least in the United States, you know, there have been arguments over whether the Supreme Court has been an agent of federal rights, federal supremacy, or an institution that has promoted states' rights. But when you look at the Nigerian experience, my argument is that the Supreme Court has not been, cannot be described as a promoter of federal hegemony, and it cannot be described as a promoter of state interest. Rather, its role has been a bit more nuanced and neutral, in that it has seen its role as trying to police the boundaries of federalism as written into the Constitution. In other words, as a kind of neutral arbiter in federal-state conflicts, rather than as an institution that is either supportive of federal authority or supportive of states' rights. And in the 14 decisions that I discussed in the paper, I found that 7 of these decisions in a way emphasized federal supremacy. And this is because of the centripetal bias written into the Nigerian Constitution. In other words, the Supreme Court supported federal supremacy because this is precisely what the Constitution provides for. In 4 other instances, out of the 14 I discussed, it promoted states' rights, especially in relation to the control of local government. And in the 3 remaining instances, it simultaneously emphasized or simultaneously affirmed both federal rights and state rights. Basically, you know, the judiciary has been very independent, and it's one of those institutions, as many who follow Nigerian affairs agree, it's one of those institutions that has given hope that Nigeria can be a democracy in spite of the kind of electoral and financial corruption that we have in the country. And the independence of the judiciary and its relatively bold and balanced role is not an accident. It is the result of an institutional design. You know, the way this, you know, the way the Supreme Court is appointed in Nigeria is such as to promote its political insulation. It's not a Supreme Court that can be packed, you know, with people who have some ideological biases. You know, it's a Supreme Court that is designed to be independent. Basically, the Supreme Court is, you know, the justices of the Supreme Court are first nominated by what is called a Federal Judicial Service Commission in Nigeria. And after they are nominated, they are then recommended for appointment by the National Judicial Council in Nigeria. It's only then that the president in Nigeria formally appoints. Basically, his hands are tied. You know, he has to appoint from the people nominated and recommended by these technocratic bodies, that is the Federal Judicial Service Commission and the National Judicial Council. So when they are, you know, when these justices are formally appointed by the president, they are now finally confirmed by the Senate. And you know, this kind of design has ensured that the judiciary is substantially insulated from any form of partisan control. And my argument is that this insulation, this political insulation of the judiciary, is a model. It's a, you know, it's a design model that should be used for other agencies in Nigeria. The reason why the last elections in Nigeria were so blatantly stolen is precisely because the election management body does not have the kind of independence that the Supreme Court has. Basically, the election management body is appointed by the president, either directly or indirectly. So the, you know, the Supreme Court has, you know, played a very, you know, has been very independent, has been very non-partisan in its arbitration of federal state conflicts in Nigeria. Now this is significantly due to the way it has been designed, to the way it has been politically insulated in the Constitution. Now, in spite of this positive role of the Supreme Court identifies some contradictions which underscore the structural limits to judicial federalism, you know, to the role of the Supreme Court. And Horowitz, in his article that I referred to in the Journal of Democracy, actually makes the same argument that there are limits, you know, there are limits to judicial engineering. That basically many of the things in politics should be left to the political process, are better guided by the political process, and that there's a limit to which the judiciary can actually arbitrate a conflict, especially in deeply divided societies. And so, for example, in spite of the role of the Supreme Court in arbitrating conflicts over revenue allocation, over the reservation, over the control of the police, the fact is that the figures indicate that Nigeria remains basically a fragile, unstable, and communally violent country, with over 10,000 lives lost since 1999, since the restoration of democracy in 1999. I also argue that the Supreme Court has sometimes been handicapped by constitutional contradictions. The Supreme Court is supposed to interpret and uphold the Constitution. But if the Constitution is ambiguous or contradictory, there is a limit to which the Supreme Court can intervene effectively. And this, again, I show in the case of Lagos State, where the Supreme Court made a decision which was neither here nor there, and which the federal government interpreted differently, and the Lagos State government interpreted quite differently, reflecting the basic ambiguity of the constitutional framework. Then I also show that actually some of the major disputes in the Federation have been effectively resolved, not by judicial arbitration, but by informal political negotiation, and formal political negotiations. In other words, there are some decisions that basically the Supreme Court was not able to resolve decisively. And a good case is the resource control case. Because the Supreme Court gave a decision that said that oil resources, offshore oil resources, should not be subject to the derivation rule. And when this created a whole kind, you know, a lot of conflict and crisis in the Niger Delta, a political solution had to be negotiated, which in a way reversed or overturned the Supreme Court decision, and which the Supreme Court eventually had to validate. So this is an indication of the sometimes the relative effectiveness of political resolution over judicial arbitration in some conflicts. Then another potential limitation is the fact that it seems that in a country as deeply divided as Nigeria, primordial and sectional considerations can undermine the effectiveness of judicial arbitration. And although so far the Supreme Court has been able to insulate itself, it has been able to rise above these ethnic, regional, and religious divisions, the danger, the potential danger is there. And one of the examples I cite in the paper is in respect of a minority judgment that was given by one of the justices of the Supreme Court from Rivers State. It was so significant that in the case over oil revenue allocation, the decision that tended to favor, the minority decision that tended to favor the oil producing areas came from a justice of the Supreme Court that came from this area. And in the case of the Sharia issue, many argue that the Supreme Court avoided making a firm, definitive decision on the Sharia because it will polarize the Supreme Court along the ethnic, religious lines. Another limitation of the role of the judiciary is the disobedience, or the manipulation of judicial decisions by the political executive. And I discussed some instances of this in the paper. For example, the decision that local government revenues should be given to the states rather than transferred directly to the local government has simply provided an excuse for the state governments to continue to hijack these revenues rather than ensure that they actually get to the localities. And so this is an instance in which the decision of the Supreme Court can be deliberately manipulated or misinterpreted by the politicians. Finally, the argument I make, which is an argument that Horowitz also makes in his article, is that sometimes in countries like Nigeria, you find that the Supreme Court decides in a very robust and effective manner some of these intergovernmental conflicts, while at the same time, the bulk of the justice sector remains basically ineffective and dysfunctional. And I think this is the situation in Nigeria. You find that the Supreme Court has been very prominent, has been very active in deciding these major disputes between the federal government and the states. But, you know, it would give a wrong impression to think that the Nigerian justice system is that efficient. What you actually find is that the justice system is dysfunctional, doesn't operate effectively, there are a lot of delays. And one of the reasons for the popularity of Sharia courts is because of the perception that the justice system doesn't work. So a focus on judicial federalism can be counterproductive if it ignores the fact that, in fact, the justice sector in Nigeria is basically seen by many people as inefficient. For people who have used the courts before in Nigeria, sometimes cases take years to be resolved. So a focus on, you know, constitutional adjudication can be counterproductive if it, you know, diverts attention from the more serious problems of the wider problems of the justice sector. So the final, you know, my final sentence, my final conclusion is that although institutionally and intellectually valuable, judicial federalism cannot be a substitute for a democratic political process, including a system of free and fair elections, a sound constitutional framework, sociocultural consensus, economic development, and even a basic rule of law that delivers justice to ordinary people. I thank you for your attention.
With the buzzing of the microphones, I'm going to ask those who came in late, if you didn't turn off your cell phones, to please do that, because that may be interfering with the sound system. And Ratima, I'm going to give you the option of coming and joining us at this table and just speaking loudly. I think we may be able to eliminate the problem with the microphones in that way. I'd also like to just thank you to start for your very thoughtful and nuanced analysis. And I'll lead off with a couple of questions, and then we'll be opening it up to the floor. We do have a lot of folks here from a highly diverse set of backgrounds from universities, private sector, NGOs, and government, and I think I'm looking forward to a very engaged discussion. The first question I would have, you mentioned and you analyzed in your paper 14 different cases. I wonder if you could just speak briefly about your selection criteria. Were these the only cases? Are these representative cases? Just try to give us a little bit more context for the selection of the cases that you've chosen. And the second question I have has to do with this evolution of the Supreme Court from military to constitutional rule. And you've mentioned that it's not been done by accident, that there's an institutional design that has helped to shape this independence. But I wonder if you could also address the role of civil society and where civil society fits into this new emerging independent court. If there is kind of an accountability mechanism that's been put in place, if civil society has been pushing in many of these conflicts, civil society is clearly in the forefront of trying to get rule of law established so that their claims might be met through a rule of law process. So I wonder if you could just say a few words about the role of civil society in this process. And then in terms of mechanisms for procedures, if you could just flag me, I'll be kind of looking around the room, scanning back and forth, and just indicate that you have a question or a comment that you'd like to make, and I'll go ahead and recognize you, and I would ask that you identify yourselves as you do that. So I'll turn over to Ratimi to start, and then maybe we'll gather a few questions and go back.
For the selection criteria, as far as I know,
these are all, you know, the my intention was to cover all the cases between the federal government and the states. You know, it's a, you know, it's a limited part of the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court, because there have been other cases, you know, especially electoral cases and whatever. These cases basically are all the cases involving the federal government and the state governments. So, as far as I know, and I think I can confidently state that, this discussion is exhaustive of all the cases between the federal government and involving the federal government and the state government that came before the Supreme Court during the two constitutional terms of the Obasanjo government from 1999 to 2007. The role of civil society, maybe not in this particular, because you know, federal state conflicts are basically conflicts between the federal government and the state. You know, they are more intergovernmental than being civil society driven. This is not to say that the civil society has not been prominent in Nigeria. I think one of the sources of hope for Nigeria is the presence of a relatively robust civil society, especially an independent media that has been in the forefront of democratization efforts. For example, that has played a very important role in criticizing the electoral fraud that has taken place in the country very recently. But in this particular set of cases, these have been cases that have involved basically a governmental institution, basically the federal government and the state governments.
My name is Sola Omoli. I'm the chef, and I'm also a Nigerian, so issues of this nature really interest me. And I'd like to thank Dr. Sudiru for very brilliant expose and presentation. And I'm happy that you ended on the note on which you ended, i.e. the Supreme Court has received what I describe as rave reviews because of their intervention as a result of the recent political experience. However, I think it will be, as you say, rightly, absolutely wrong to think that that's the case for the entire judicial system in the country. And because I truly believe that the political evolution is going to take a long while for us to see a situation where you then have elections that are free and fair and there's a claim generally, it's going to take a while. Therefore, our hope will continue to rest with the judicial system. Where I'm going with this is, at the state level, there's huge problems. I mean, if you think back to the cases of impeached governors in certain states, the role of the judiciary was absolutely condemnable. Does the Supreme Court have a role in terms of impacting on the lower level courts so that we can begin to witness the kind of credibility and truly dispassionate judgments that we're witnessing in the Supreme Court at this time?
Do you want to respond or take some more?
Maybe.
What do you prefer? We have
maybe
one here.
Yeah.
Okay, why don't we take yours and yours?
My name is Adere Wampa, I work just two blocks down the road at the Mathematics Division of Humboldt University. And I'm Nigerian as well. And just like most Nigerians, you know, I've watched with dismay, you know, the conduct of the last election. And my opinion of the success or the lack of it of the Supreme Court would also have to do with how they handle the fallout from the last elections. And you know, following the events over there, I know that there's a designated amount of time, I don't know what it is, you know, when they would, within which they would have to adjudicate the complaints of the losing candidates in the last election. And there are some potentially high-profile cases, you know, coming up. In your opinion, and this is my question, is this one of those instances where the Supreme Court is going to be limited in what they can do to straighten out some of, you know, the most egregious abuses of the law.
My name is Aya Ligon from Power University. The possibility to thank you for a very good paper on this Supreme Court in relation to the Constitution itself, also that you have brought out in the Constitution. But my own observation or question relate to the contradiction you mentioned about the Constitution. Yeah, that is very contentious. This is a military constitution. What we have now is a military constitution. It's not a Nigerian constitution. It's a military who imposed it. And then the role of the government, I'm in Nigeria also. I mentioned some of the things I wanted to talk about.
I wonder if you could speak up just a bit. I'm getting signs that people in the back can't hear. Sorry.
The Constitution itself is very contentious, like you said, and this is what the Supreme Court is supposed to interpret. They're supposed to interpret the law, the organic law of the land, which is the Constitution. But the Constitution itself, many people in Nigeria are still debating it, whether this is acceptable, whether this is people's Constitution, which the Supreme Court should even interpret at all, because this is a military Constitution, and the civilian administration have accepted it as the constitution of the land. And this is why it is creating problems within the country, within the civilian society, even the civil society. You mentioned it, which is very important. Nigerian civil society now, they are very, very active, and they are involved in what is going on in the country, in the judiciary, in the political. But the civil society themselves, they are condemning this constitution. It's a big issue. Unless we have people's constitution, though Yar'Adua has promised to amend, you know, the constitution, but some people are saying we need a new constitution of amendment, because so that this, we can have a Supreme Court which will be able to interpret it. Like you said, we have independent judiciary, particularly Supreme Court, but the appeal court and the local court is not. It's unlike the Supreme. They're very corrupt. They dance to the tune of the politicians in the states. So this is a major problem. You mentioned the case of the Lagos State, in which the governor created a local government and local governments and demanded for allocation. I think it was a very, very contradictory issue. But if the way I look at the case, the judgment of the Supreme was in favor of the state, but because our federal system is not really federalism, Nigeria federal system is, we say we are operating federal system in name, but in practicality we are operating a unitary system of government. If we look at the way federal system is operated in Canada, in India, in Australia, in this country, because everything is centralized, every governor has to go to Abuja to beg for money, to ask for the police itself, which you mentioned, that's very, very important. We have a national police, which is also creating problems. This is one of the things that the civil society is crying for, that we need to have, you know, decentralized. And again, you mentioned about the Niger Delta directly, or the onshore, offshore oil issue. This is a major issue. You know, the Niger Delta is the major issue in Nigeria today. This also is very, very important, which need to be resolved. It's been centralized. This is not right. When we say we are operating a democratic system, under a judicial system also, and under a capitalist system, and the federal government control the resources, which is supposed to be decentralized. I would like you to comment on this. What role will the judiciary play in this? And particularly today, I think he has mentioned it, can the Supreme Court have any influence on the appeal court from the states?
Why don't we take those questions and let you get have a shot, and then we have a few others that I think are around the table.
Thank you very much. Yes, regarding the, yeah, you are, you know, Mr. Omole is perfectly right about the fact that below the Supreme Court, the lower, branches of the judiciary, you've had a lot of corruption. And one good example, which I referred to briefly in the paper, is the case of the Enugu State High Court Judge Nnamdi, who gave a decision actually deposing the governor of a neighboring state. Somebody said, it is roughly equivalent to a New Jersey County judge deposing the governor of New York, in one of him. And of course, the Supreme Court said in that instance that, look, even if a decision looks arbitrary, as long as it's from the court, it has to be obeyed until it is overturned on appeal. So you've had a lot of corruption in the lower tiers of the judicial system. But to answer your question directly, there is a mechanism for the control of the lower levels of judiciary, and this is the National Judicial Council, which is headed by the Chief Justice of the Federation. And in the case of the Enugu, Nnamdi of Enugu, he was actually dismissed from the judiciary, and you had several people who have been dismissed on grounds of corruption. So the National Judicial Council operates as a kind of regulatory mechanism that ensures that corrupt judicial officers are disciplined. And we've had, not just the Nnamdi case, we've had federal high court judges who took bribes during election petitions, who have also been dismissed. About five of them have been dismissed. So there's a mechanism in place to ensure that the judicial, the lower levels of the judicial system try to keep in line with the high standards that have been, that have been established by the Supreme Court. Yes, a various question about the possible role of the Supreme Court in resolving some potentially high-profile cases. I think this will be a severe test for the Supreme Court, and it will also be an illustration to me of the limitations of the reliance on the judiciary. Basically, if you don't have a system of free and fair elections, as we do in as we don't in Nigeria, and then you rely on the courts to kind of provide what is called in Nigeria electoral justice, I think it's very dangerous, because it's going to get the courts politicized. For a lot of the cases, the election petition cases, they will terminate at the level of the Court of Appeal, basically. But for the presidential election case, which is going to be the real high profile case, it will have to go to the Supreme Court. It may end in the Supreme Court. And I think it will put the Supreme Court in a very difficult situation. Those elections were really, even the presidential election was very fraudulent. But I think it would be very dangerous for the Supreme Court to say, to annul, the presidential elections. So I think, we really have, your question really points to the fact that we really have to find a way to ensure the integrity of an electoral system and reduce dependence on the judiciary for some of these highly partisan cases. As for the Constitution, and this is the point, maybe I wasn't very clear. I tried to make the argument that the Nigerian Constitution is comparatively remarkable in terms of the kind of provisions it has established. One of these is the National Judicial Council. People say, because you have this National Judicial Council headed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, which is a federal institution, which assumes responsibility for appointing, nominating, and disciplining judges of the lower courts. And people say this is an example of over-centralization. At the same time, it has played a role in ensuring some kind of quality control. Also, the issue of a unitary police. Most people argue against a single police force. But when you had vigilante bodies like the ISBA being established by the states, and then this become, you know, instruments for terrorizing non-indigenous, non-Muslims and whatever, people then recognize some of the value in having a relatively centralized police. The same thing with oil resources. Now, if you say that all oil revenues should be assigned to the states in Nigeria, what you have is a disparity between the oil producing areas. Already, with the current constitution, the non-oil producing states are already complaining that they are getting, the oil producing states are getting sometimes five times what other states are getting. So, I agree that the constitution is the way it was. The way the constitution was established is procedurally flawed. But in terms of its substantive provisions, I think I see some merits in the Nigeria's federal constitution.
You've got, is it one there and there?
First of all, I would like to thank you. My name is Patrick Okata, and I'm with American University. I would like to thank you, first of all, for bringing some clarity to a very difficult issue. I think even lawyers do not comprehend very much the tricky issue that the Supreme Court or even the lower courts have to deal with when there are certain disputes between the state and the federal government. And I think you've tried as much as possible to illuminate some of the contentious problems that can really come out in the way that those problems are looked at. I also want to make a comment about the role of the civil society. I think to some extent the lack of prominence of the civil society organizations in this general area has to do with the lack of standing. They do not really have standing to be involved in any of these cases. So the best way they can even be involved is as a friend of the court, in a way. And so I think that limits their ability to play a very significant role in those disputes between the state and the federal government. But my question to you probably has to do with the role of the National Judicial Council. It appears that they only really come down and actually do their job when you have very egregious violations by judicial officials. And so my question to you is, how do we begin to get the Judicial Council to perform a role of maybe providing a very coherent structure for the adjudication of not just state-federal disputes, but adjudication of disputes generally? Because you mentioned the lag time it takes between when cases are filed and when they are actually disposed of by the various courts. And also, when one looks very carefully at the way the state courts conduct themselves, sometimes they leave very little to be desired. And so, you think there is a mechanism or ways by which the National Judicial Council can begin to have a stream, put in place a more streamlined structure that can then give some level of credibility to the judiciary in general. And I mean, this, I know, is a tricky thing to do, given the vacillation during military rules almost have a self-censorship by the judiciary, and then some level of activism under civilian rule. So, can all of that be reconciled within this national structure that then gives some level of credibility?
I'm Carl Levan. I'm also from American University, but I'm not a Nigerian. And I want to thank Professor Subaru for a really excellent presentation, and I've learned a great deal over the years about federalism in general from him, so it's great to, it's been great to have him in Washington, D.C. As you know, I mean, one of the signs of a strong federal system, strong structure, is a strong power of judicial review. The scope is basically unlimited. And what's interesting about the cases that you've described is that I think the court has been fairly nuanced and tried very hard to be balanced and sometimes delicate. And I think part of that is because of the unfortunate complexity of the Constitution, actually. There are many, many problems with the Constitution that, and it's really to the credit of the court that they've managed to find some clarity in that rather long document. But there's other, features of, I think, the system which suggests, as was pointed out earlier, that that it is a very weak federal system. And so maybe that's a sign of caution about being optimistic about the courts and the court's role in advancing democracy. And just to give you a few ideas of what I have in mind, one is, of course, that the states themselves don't have constitutions, which is extremely problematic. And I pose that also as a question because I'm wondering if this has come up a little bit more. I mean, my experience with the states was in really 1999 and 2000, as you know, and this was coming up then at the time. And then even the decision that you mentioned about revenues accruing to the states rather than to the local government areas directly, which was a decision initially implemented by the military governments, that even a decision like that can undermine the autonomy of local governments as sub-federal units. Lastly, along the lines of what I'm thinking is that, you know, elements of the political system have at times worked to undercut, those efforts of centralization. And in particular, I'm thinking of certain party activities which have really tried to challenge that a centripetal motion of bringing of centralizing power. But again, the courts have been pretty much hands off on party matters, which is really the core of the corruption of these elections is occurring, as virtually everyone today has acknowledged. So I just throw that as sort of my own list of concerns about, you know, how federal the system is, even though it does seem to have this one important feature of strong judicial review and relatively independent court system.
Thank you, Ruth. This is a typically fine presentation and a good paper. Since 2000, Nigeria has found itself in a fairly unique position, even among federal systems, having two criminal codes operating at the national level. The Sharia code in the northern tier, 12 states, and a civil code or common law in 24 states. And there seems to have emerged over the last 7 years a tacit political acceptance by elites that this is an acceptable status quo and it's sustainable. And regardless of our judgment about that, it would seem that the most recent ruling on the HISBA is an indication that the court is stepping back along with the political authorities and saying, we're not going to go near this. So if you could comment, I'd be appreciative.
Could you also identify yourself?
Oh, sorry, Peter Lewis, John Thompson.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for those accepted comments. On the role of civil society, I think you are, right that Nigeria has a very rigid standing rule, which really prevents a lot of people, denies a lot of people access to the courts. But in with regard to the role of the National Judicial Council, I think a potential opportunity for the civil societies is actually bringing cases of corruption, because there's no limitation to who can bring reports to the National Judicial Council. And I see this as a very huge potential opportunity for the civil society to participate and contribute to this process by actually bringing instances, reporting instances of corruption to the National Judicial Council. As far as I can determine, I think the National Judicial Council, when it is confronted with, and this is a very professional body, its representation even by from the Nigerian Bar Association, when it is confronted with clear cases of judicial corruption, it investigates and recommends the dismissal of judges. And it has done this with respect to Nnamdi, with respect to some judges indicted in relation to elections petition arising from the 2003 election. So I think, by and large, it has played a very impressive role. Civil society can contribute to that role by bringing cases of judicial corruption before the Judicial Council. Yeah, I think, Carl, you are right. That's obvious, and I think I indicated in the presentation that the federal system is flawed, and that even a focus on judicial federalism can actually have this counterproductive effect of diverting attention from some of the flaws of the system. And one of the basic, one of the more fundamental flaws is the absence of an independent electoral system and electoral management system, which in a way contributes to a flawed partisan. Because if you do not have a free and fair process of elections that disciplines the party, that makes them disciplined in response to the competition for the votes of the people, then you can't have a viable party system. So I see this as a fundamental flaw that affects the party system. When you don't have free and fair elections, it means parties can afford not to be democratic internally, because they know they can, impose candidates and rig elections and, So that's a basic flaw of the system. But I don't agree with you necessarily that the fact that states don't have their own constitution is a fundamental, it's a fundamental liability. Because if you look at I think Canada, for example, I doubt whether, the Canadian provinces have independent constitutions of their own. Yet, this is one of the most decentralized federation in the world. In fact, I think Ivo Duchasek about 20 years ago wrote an article on state constitutions, and he found that these are really not, for example, in the Latin American federations, they've copied the American example of having state constitutions. But for a long time, these constitutions didn't make, a lot of the Latin American federations remained highly centralized, in spite of the fact that their states had conscience of their own. I think that may not, that a lot depends on the party system. If you have a vibrant party system, it will ensure that, states get the kind of autonomy that they are able to bargain for politically. So I think having states conscience may not be such a fundamental defect of the Nigerian federal system. Yes, I think, Peter, you are right in your reading, and that's my own reading of the decision of the Supreme Court regarding Sharia. I think basically it has taken the decision that it's not going to entangle itself in such a symbolically explosive issue. And its strategy, which I think may be right in a sense, is to say, let the lower courts decide in the first instance, and then the Supreme Court can then decide at the appeal, on appeal, which I think would be, a very, to me, a politically correct way of responding to these very explosive issues, because the kind of issues involved in the Sharia controversy are so complex, so potentially contentious, that I think the courts themselves should be cautious in inserting themselves into that kind of dispute. For example, the constitution says that the government of the states or the federation shall not adopt any religion as a state religion. Nobody really knows what that means. Whether some people say it's that means a secular state. Others say it, you know, it's a, you know, it only says that Nigerian state should be multi-religious. So this is a deeply controversial and contentious issue to on which the Supreme Court, I think, should be very cautious in intervening. And I think maybe the political resolution, a political approach, will be a much more effective way of responding to this than a judicial decision.
I think we had someone who fell out of the queue back there, and I apologize. Do you want to go ahead?
I'm sorry I came in later, but this might have been addressed, or if not, you threw more light on it. My name is Martin Nkwain. I'm of the ABSS or IMF. And again, I'm a brother state in Nigeria. I'm from Cameroon. So, all what has been said, just part of what we are living in Cameroon, even though under a military state, the currency is decentralized as they call it. So coming back to the topic now, I differ a little bit with the role the thing the Supreme Court can have over the state courts. Because the truth is, the state courts will be more decisive, they will be more forceful in decision making and the rules they play than the Supreme Court. Because even like the one we have in Cameroon, we call it, it says independent, we will put it on board. You know, we mostly term it a political entity. Trust me, the chief judges of the Supreme Court are politicians in hiding. They will not take a decision without the executive telling them what to do. They are like figureheads. So it will surprise me. The Frenchman says in Cameroon, jamais vu. That is, it has never happened and it may not happen that they may go in this time around and cancel a presidential election. They say jamais vu. No matter the discrepancies, the fraud which everybody knows, they will say yes and they will put him back on that field. Because, as I say, they are politicians. And those who are fired, believe me, these are only people who are not playing the political game, who are not with the party that is in power. All the little guns who are corrupt, who are thieves, who do all what we think evil, they die and cover themselves with the party in power. So they are not touched, they are untouchable. But those who don't link to the party in power, they are with the opposition, they get tired that quick. So now, sir, put us more light the role of the Supreme Court. They call it independent, and the role of the executive. Yeah. Are they not in Cameroon? Are they not one body in Nigeria? Don't they act like one person? If they simply this, really keep them independent as we think, most of these things will just be taken care of. So that is just my puzzle. What is leading on is because these two people are asking, there are actually one person, even though they call one independent. They work hand in hand, hand in glove.
Okay, I think this will be the last round of questions. If there's anybody who hasn't had their question raised, let me know. Otherwise, I'll just toss out one additional question, maybe ask you in the short time remaining if you might venture a few suggestions about transferability of what you've learned from Nigerian federalism to other cases. Any kind of key points that you might highlight? You've mentioned a number that I think do have some applicability, but if you might just summarize a bit.
If you read my paper, I think one of the very remarkable things that we have done in Nigeria is this attempt to insulate the judiciary. And I can say, very confidently that the Supreme Court in Nigeria is independent by design, by the way it's designed. And to me, this underscores the importance of institutional design. You know, if you create an institution that ensures that the Supreme Court is insulated from executive control, then the Supreme Court can behave independently. If you ensure that it is its appointment, its funding, its operational direction is insulated from executive control, then it can function independently. And that is what has happened in Nigeria. And you know, the Supreme Court has given a lot of decisions that have really upset the executive. You know, a good example, which I didn't discuss in this paper because it doesn't deal with a federal state conflict, is the decision over the vice president in Nigeria. He was engaged in a bitter public feud with the president, and the president did everything to obstruct, to obstruct and frustrate him and to disqualify, to keep him off the ballot. But the court decided that, you know, this candidate is eligible for election. And the, you know, the worst Obasanjo could do was, he declared 2 days of public holidays just to, you know, to delay the decision of his, you know. But that was all he could do. Basically, the Supreme Court gave a decision that, he didn't like, and, you know, but he couldn't do anything about it. I think so. This is one area I think that Nigeria has done very well to insulate, to insulate the judiciary. And if you extend that model, the reason why, you know, the judiciary in other countries and in the past in Nigeria has been dependent is because their appointments, their funding, and their removal was, under executive control. But if you remove that, and Nigeria has shown that it's feasible, then the judiciary, can become quite independent. Yeah, Arab transferability. Yeah, this is what I've been trying to grapple with. The comparison, and it's a very important aspect of my project. You know, looking at how the Nigerian experience compares to other countries, especially countries like India and like Canada, which are similarly ethnically and regionally contested, but which have also proved to be resilient. So for me, your question is still an ongoing project, but I can say, for example, that in terms of the role of the courts, in India too, reading the Indian material, I find that the courts have also been very decisive in turning what was dismissed as a pseudo-federal arrangement into a more centralized and into a more decentralized and more authentically federal arrangement. Because in the past in India, for example, there's what is called presidential rule, by which Indian prime ministers will just sack state governments. But now this, the courts in India are saying that before you can do that, you have to really show that this, that the state governments are either going to collapse into anarchy. In other words, it can't just be done arbitrarily. And this has been one of the major factors, responsible for the gradual decentralization and strengthening of Indian federalism. And I think that's a lesson that also resonates in the Nigerian context. So I'm taking the issue of transferability comparability seriously, and I'm going to address it in the project.
Wonderful. Well, we're all looking forward to Rotimi's book coming out. It will be a little while yet, but if you're not already on USIP's mailing list, please go to our website and sign up so that you will get notice about the other events around Nigeria or issues that you indicate you're interested in, and you'll also get notice when the book comes out. Thank you all for your engagement with this discussion. You've really contributed a lot as well to the project, and we'll look forward to further discussion with Rotimi if you'd like afterwards. I would just note that we have a project report that was scheduled for this Thursday by Rind Rahim Frankie on Iraq. She is still in Baghdad and will be unable to give that talk. We will postpone it for a later date, and if you keep posted on our website, you'll find out when that will be once she gets back. There's one additional remaining project report that has been canceled. Senior fellow Jennifer Shermer is recovering from a fractured leg, so we have gone ahead and suspended that indefinitely. But thank you again for coming, and we hope that you have a good afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.